Hey everyone, my name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, the place where I've done interviews with over 1,000 entrepreneurs. My goal is to hear the story of how they built their businesses so that you, my listener, will continue to build your business, not so much based on how they've done it, but with the knowledge that comes from understanding their stories. And my vision is that you listen to these interviews, build great companies, and then you come back here and do an interview yourself to talk about how you did it. Well, long before I did all this, I lived in New York where I grew up, and I remember going to Austin Street in Queens to buy glasses back when I wore glasses. And I thought that by going into the local store and picking out the different brands and shelling out hundreds of dollars, which frankly for me, I was a high school and then college student doing this, actually a college student, that's a lot of money. I thought that I was actually picking the company I liked the best. Turns out I was wrong. It turns out it was basically one company that not only made all the glasses in the store, but actually owned the store and probably the insurance company that I had at the time, though I don't remember the brand of insurance that my parents had. Well, today's guest noticed that too and said, hey, you know what? There's probably a better way. We don't have to have this one monolith. We could create our own brand, our own interaction with customers, actually charge less and have glasses that are cooler and available to be bought online. And by doing that, he built what is considered a unicorn, one of these highly valued companies. I invited him here to talk about how he did it. His name is Neil Blumenthal. He is the co-founder of Warby Parker. It's a vertically integrated lifestyle brand that's working to transform the optical industry. This interview is sponsored by two companies. I'll tell you more about them later. The first is TopTal, which will help you find a great developer. The next will help you find a great design. It's called Design Crowd. Neil, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I understand that you guys are a unicorn, meaning you're worth more than $1 billion. What is the valuation at the latest raise?
We generally don't speak about valuations or revenue per se publicly. It has been reported that our last round that we were valued at $1.2 billion, and that was almost 2 years ago.
Almost 2 years ago. And the company is how old now?
We're about to celebrate our seventh birthday.
So that is fantastic growth in such a short period of time. I love that you're still happy to share the story because I want to get the fundamentals of the story in, and then I've got to dig in deeper with some of the research that I've done about you. The fundamental part of this story is the beginning is you met your three co-founders where?
At business school at Wharton. We were all full-time MBA students.
Why did you go get an MBA? You're a guy with a lot of experience. You see the startup world. You know, as you've told other people, MBAs aren't that valued in the startup world. Why do that?
For me, I've been working in the nonprofit sector, and I was running a nonprofit called Vision Spring that would train low-income women in the developing world to start their own businesses, giving eye exams and selling glasses. Mm-hmm. And even though I had done this for over 5 years, I had opened up programs in 10 different countries, including an office in Hyderabad, which is one of the global tech centers. I had been to China and had worked on manufacturing. I had built a global supply chain. Because of my sort of nonprofit background, I felt like I didn't have the credibility that I needed to transition to the for-profit sector. In business school is a great opportunity if people want to switch careers or start something anew. You get this stamp of approval, particularly from a place like Wharton, which is just known for being expert in finance and operations. I think the dirty little secret about Wharton is that they also are great around preparing leaders, around management. It's got the most published marketing department out there. And you see a lot of value-based companies come out of Wharton like Warby Parker. So it was a perfect fit for me.
So what's the impetus that got you to launch Warby Parker?
Literally trying to solve our own problem. So I started Warby Parker with three friends, Jeff Rader, Andy Hunt, and Dave Gilboa. And we happened to be talking about glasses, and we were doing so in the computer lab in Huntsman Hall at Wharton. Dave was complaining that he just lost a $700 pair of glasses. He left it in the seat pocket of an airplane because he was traveling right before school started. He had worked at a bank so he could afford a $700 pair of glasses. And Andy had a similar story. Jeff had a similar story. Andy posited the question, why isn't anybody selling glasses online? Because we had all seen, e-commerce just explode, in particular for categories that you never thought could work online, like Zappos selling shoes and Blue Nile selling engagement rings. And I think we take that all for granted. But, 8 years ago, before we launched Warby Parker, nobody thought that you could sell glasses online. But for us, the light bulb started to go off. That conversation was cut short because we had to run to class. But then later that evening, when you have a feeling and it's in the gut of your stomach and you can't sleep, it was one of those nights. And at 2 a.m, I emailed Jeff, Andy, and Dave. And at 2:01, Dave responded. And at 2:02, Jeff responded. And then Andy responded. And we were all up just thinking about this idea.
So you said that no one had been selling glasses online, but the nonprofit that you guys support sprung out of, is the name Skojo?
Yes, exactly, Skojo.
Skojo sells glasses online now, and as far as I could tell, they were selling it even before you guys were. They were reading glasses. It wasn't anything beyond that, right?
It was reading glasses, and it was primarily sold through drugstores and department stores. So Skojo was started by Dr. Jordan Castello and Scott Berry. The name actually comes from their two names.
Oh, that's where it came from. I see. Okay.
They sort of thought, wow, there's this hole in the market where you can buy either really cheap reading glasses at, a gas station for a couple dollars, or you have to go buy prescription glasses that could be several hundred dollars. What if we created well-designed reading glasses and sold them, maybe for $45, but that would be almost to the quality of a prescription pair of glasses. And it was a really innovative idea. They've since sold Skojo to a larger company. But if you want reading glasses, it's a great option.
How much of that was an inspiration for Warby Parker, that if these guys could take something and put it online a little bit, but also add a lot of design to it and turn it into a brand, and maybe we can?
I think there were some learnings there. I think one was not to separate the mission from the commercial aspect too much, which I think they did. I think the other lesson was that I never want to be in the wholesale business and dependent on other retailers for the growth of your business. On them for margins. I think for a few reasons. One is that buyers can be fickle, and you could be doing big business through one of these retailers, and then at a drop of the dime, they could drop you, and suddenly you see a big hole in your business. I think the second thing is that you don't have a direct line to your customers. So the feedback that you're getting is often through these other retailers. And if you want to make great product, if you want to create awesome services, you need to be interacting directly with customers and getting feedback. So that way you can change attributes of your product, improve it. You can be providing great customer service. You don't have control over the brand if you're wholesaling to a third party who's then selling it to somebody else.
Okay. So what I wonder every time I read your story is I see four co-founders, which seems more than most tech companies have. I always wonder, why didn't you, Neil, say, you know what? David, Jeffrey, and Andrew are really smart guys. I'll pick one of them and we'll become co-founders. And the other two will help us get going, but they're not going to be full co-founders. Why did you want all three?
This idea was really born out of conversations the four of us had. And even though this is probably not the A-team that you would have created to create.
It feels like it.
I think the results speak for themselves. But if you look at our backgrounds, you got me as the nonprofit international development guy.
Yeah.
Now, of course, I had some background in the optical industry, sort of related, so I think that was helpful. Dave had worked at Bain & Company as a management consultant, and then at Allen & Company as an investment banker. Andy had been a banker. Jeff had been a consultant at Bain & Company as well, and then was working in private equity at Charles Bank. So there were definitely some overlapping skill sets, right? You didn't have your technology expert and software engineer. You didn't have a manufacturing expert. You didn't have a retail and branding expert. But I think what you did have was people that recognized a problem, had an idea of a solution, and then were just relentless in learning as much as possible to create a new way. Now, we were full-time students at Wharton, as I mentioned, so we had some time to really dedicate to this, so it wasn't like we had full-time jobs. So we had an opportunity to think through what was our strategy, and then we had an opportunity to stress test that with friends, with professors. We had an opportunity to just learn as much as possible about these areas of the business that we wouldn't be expert in. And we knew sort of once we graduated that, you know, maybe this business will be successful, maybe it won't be, but to have four of us sort of running it as, you know, co-chief executives probably wouldn't work. Jeff had committed to go back to the private equity fund that he was working at before school. They were paying for school. So it was never an option for him to continue beyond sort of graduation. He's since gone on to, he went back to Charles Bank for 2 years, then has since started Harry's, sort of the razor company. That's sort of like a sister company that's trying to take on the razor industry and charges half of what Gillette charges.
And also is a design-based company like Warby Parker.
Exactly.
I see. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, Andy was more passionate about investing. He went into venture capital. And Dave and I were excited to sort of run and grow the business. So we continue to run it as co-CEOs.
So I've been, Neil, doing a lot of these interviews and hearing entrepreneurs say, I found a problem and then I built a business. A lot of times the next step was to make sure that the problem that they found wasn't one that they only experienced, you know, so that they're not just solving their own personal problem, but they're understanding there is a bigger problem here. Here's how the rest of the world experiences it. It's a shade different from mine, but that is a meaningful shade. Did you do any of that to understand that there were other people who were losing their glasses or were upset about the price?
Absolutely.
How did you do it?
We did it a few different ways. One is that we would just ask people in a very anecdotal way. The other is, given you know, a few of us have been management consultants, we put together surveys and we would harass our classmates. We had, you know, 800 classmates at Wharton, and they got a bunch of surveys from us asking, "Hey, how frequently do you buy glasses? How much did you pay for your last pair? What brand did you buy? Are you happy?" We did a lot of research on the industry and found that there was one very large company named Luxottica that's about $25 billion market cap that owns Oakley, Ray-Ban, Persol, Arnett, Oliver Peoples, a bunch of other brands. They license pretty much all the brands out there like Ralph Lauren, Chanel, Dolce & Gabbana, Prada. They also own a lot of the retail chains that most people shop at like LensCrafters, Pearle Vision, Sunglass Hut, Sears Optical, Target Optical, and they own iMed, the second largest vision insurance plan in the country. So when we saw this dynamic, the light bulb went off and was like, huh, like there are incentives to keeping, you know, glasses expensive. And the market was big, so over $100 billion globally. So, right, we started checking all these boxes of this is an interesting opportunity with a widespread sort of problem.
How did you understand, or what was the problem as other people express it? And I understand that prices is an issue that, of course, when your co-founder loses a $700 pair of glasses, it's painful. But as one of your professors, I think, said to you, actually, price is how people value the brand, that if you charge more, people value it more. And so maybe it didn't hurt these companies that they were very expensive. How did you understand that the price was a problem for people? There were pain points with shopping in a store as opposed to doing it online. What can you tell me a little bit more of the feedback that you got that told you, yes, we really are finding a clear problem here?
Yeah, I think the big thing was that price was an issue. It wasn't like people were screaming from the mountaintops, "Hey, glasses are so expensive." But when you ask people, "How much did you pay?" they would sort of say, "Oh man, you know, $400, or, oh man, $300, or, oh man, $500. So it wasn't something like they necessarily always felt ripped off, but they sure didn't want to talk about it. And as they reflected upon it, they're like, yeah, that was expensive. I don't understand why glasses cost as much of as an iPhone, right?
I see. More actually at the time.
Exactly.
I see. Because you know what? Because there's some things that if I ask someone how much they paid for it, they're kind of proud that they paid a lot for it, that they got the top of the line most expensive because it means that it's more out of reach for other people. And so it's more special. I see. You're not just looking at their survey results. You're also looking at their body language and the words and the expressions they use to describe that price. And you're picking up on frustration with the price. What about online shopping? I really think that as I was going through Quora questions, the whole idea of online shopping, even to this day for glasses, is scary to people. Did you pick up on anything that said people don't want to go to stores, just like they don't want to go to stores to buy shoes? How did you pick up on that?
Well, nobody wanted to shop online. So I don't think we were solving for a problem that nobody was buying glasses online before us. It was more that it was this white space and this opportunity. In fact, our customer research showed that people didn't want to buy glasses online, and that gave us a lot of pause, and it forced us to rethink this idea of launching a business online to sell a product that people wanted to touch and feel, that they wanted to try on and look in the mirror with. So, you know, all these entrepreneurial journeys are like emotional roller coasters. One minute you feel super smart, the next minute you feel like you're the biggest idiot on the planet. We were in this trough where we were like, ah, God, we don't know if anyone who wants to buy glasses online because they want to touch and feel them. And it was sort of being in those doldrums of uncertainty that led us to this idea of a home try-on program where customers could go online, select five pairs of glasses, we'll ship it to them for free. They have 5 days to try it on at home. That idea gave us the confidence to invest more time and money into the Warby Parker concept. And eventually when we launched, it was a big part of our success. GQ called us the Netflix of eyewear.
Because you were sending so many so many glasses to your customers' home the way that Netflix used to with DVDs.
Exactly.
I see.
The other thing that the home try-on problem solved was potentially a high return rate, which would have destroyed the economics of the business. So when somebody returns a pair of glasses, you actually have to throw out the lenses because it's almost statistically impossible that somebody has the same prescription in each eye, has the same pupillary distance, the measure between your two pupils, and wants the same frame. So if we had return rates like Zappos does, then the business just wouldn't work because we would have been spending so much on lenses that got thrown out. So the thought is that this home try-on program not only eliminates that friction point of people not wanting to buy online because they want to touch and feel the glasses and try them on, but it also hopefully reduces the return rate and makes this a viable business.
I see. Okay. And so if I'm understanding right, you found your own problem. You said, look, there are other people who clearly experience this problem. It's too expensive. You also said we need to go online because there's white space. There's nobody really doing this right online. And you knew because you talked to people that online was a pain for them. And you said we have to solve this pain that we're about to inflict on our customers. And you came up with a way that actually ended up delighting them. They get to try the glasses on at home. Not only did you overcome the pain, but you created this positive experience for them. Am I right?
Exactly. Okay. You know, I think we saw e-commerce not so much that we – you know, believe in e-commerce above all other forms of selling, but because it was the fastest, least expensive way for us to build a direct relationship with our customers. So, and why that's important is that the reason why we're able to provide a $500 pair of glasses for $95 is because we cut out the middleman and we don't wholesale and we sell direct to customers. So for us to start, we were either going to have to open up stores right away or build a website. And it was cheaper to build a website.
So the company that I mentioned earlier, Sojo, Sojo built their site, as far as I could tell, on Magento. They didn't have experience building e-commerce sites, so they just used a framework that was available and free. You guys seem to, despite not having a technical co-founder, you seem to have built the whole thing yourselves from scratch, and I'm wondering who built it for you?
So one of the things that we did was sort of sketch out and wireframe the website before we hired anybody to build it. So, you know, given the management consulting and banking background of our four-person team, if there was one thing that we could do, it was create nice decks and PowerPoint. So this was a moment, again, 2008, 2009, we launched in 2010, where desktop e-commerce was king. So, you know, a slide on PowerPoint kind of looks like the screen of a desktop. So we would literally map out what each web page would look like on PowerPoint. We would then print that out and do sort of physical user testing with our friends to say, hey, this is the home page. What button would you press? Oh, that takes you to the gallery page. What button? That takes you to the product page. And what this enabled us to do was have a really tight scope in which we could go to vendors, you know, and say, hey, how much would it cost to build this? And, you know, when you were, this is just true for any sort of vendor customer relationship, vendors will charge you more if there's uncertainty. So the more that you can be specific with what you want, right, the better deal you're going to get. We went to four different dev shops to get quotes on, hey, build, you know, please build our website. One of them came at half the price of the other three. So we said, oh, great, let's go with these guys. This was lesson number one. Don't always go with the cheapest vendor. Uh-huh. And literally within 6 months, we had to fire this vendor. All the code they'd written was terrible. We had to find a new one, and that set us back and delayed the launch by a few months.
I see. All right, let me take a moment here. Actually, this kind of ties into my first sponsor, which is a company called TopTal. They take what you just said to heart. Their goal is to hire not the cheapest developers, but the best developers they can. Neil, these guys pride themselves on having a test for each developer that screens out and shows the door to 97% of the people who want to work at TopTal. The top 3% are available in a network. Anyone who's looking to hire a developer can just go to TopTal and hire from them. Are you clicking over to TopTal's website?
No, I was trying to, I accidentally moved you to the side.
Oh, got it. Okay. I thought maybe there was like some bug or an issue. So I actually had this guy in my office yesterday, a guy named Eric Brown. He showed me his software. He said, Andrew, I know that you're trying to reconfigure your business here. Let me show you the software that I built to help you think through your business and teach your team how to run it. And I said, this is beautiful. This is what, a beta? He goes, yeah, I'm not ready to show it to the world. I said, Eric, how do you build this thing? He goes, I didn't. I heard your ad about TopTal. I hired TopTal. They built this thing. It looks really great. And I still have visions for how to improve it. So that's the goal behind TopTal. You go to them with your engineering need, tell them what you're working on, how you and your team work, or maybe it's just like Eric, you're just a single person working on it by yourself. They find the best developers for you or single developer. They match you up. If it's a good fit, you can often start within a day or two. And if you're happy, you can continue working with them full-time, part-time, project basis, etc. If you're out there and you're listening to me, TopTal was created by a Mixergy fan who went on to greatness, raise money from Andreessen Horowitz. And because they started out, the two fans who built TopTal, because they went on to greatness and they want to give back to the Mixergy community and frankly to help me, and I appreciate it, they're giving my audience 80 hours of TopTal developer credit when you pay for your first 80 hours. And that's in addition to a no-risk trial period of up to 2 weeks. If you're listening to me and you want the best of the best developers, TopTal is the place to go. And a special URL that they created for us is where you get this 80 hours of developer credit. Just go to toptal.com/Mixergy. Top as in top of the heap, tal as in talent, toptal.com/Mixergy. Neil, the thing that I always admired and was intimidated by you is your design and your brand. I'm actually like, I'm looking at you now. Don't take this like negatively, but I'm looking at you. You're wearing a blue button down with the collar button down. You look like an MBA student. You don't look like a tattooed bearded guy that I would be intimidated to even order a cup of coffee next to because you'd have a cooler cup of coffee in mind. Where did this design come from? Where did the designs of the first glasses come from?
Does it help that it's an APC button down?
Wait, what's an APC? I don't even know that actually. So yeah, it does help.
It's just, it's a brand.
Okay.
But yeah, I think my aesthetic and I dress in a very sort of simple, classic way. Yeah, no, I'm certainly by no means a classically trained designer, never went to fashion school. I did grow up in Manhattan downtown in Greenwich Village. Mm-hmm. I do think that there's something to being in the city that just exposes you to a bunch of different industries, that exposes you to culture. If you want it, that you can sort of create a certain taste level. So when I think about the people that built great brands, I don't know if it's necessarily all the formal training that they've received versus just having a particular point of view. And the taste level, and the four of us had a very specific point of view of what type of brand we wanted to create.
A shared point of view.
It was about building something that stood for fun, creativity, and doing good in the world. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as we start to build out literally the brand architecture, we kept coming back to writers. Because of the link between vision and learning and reading, and the fact that writers are often on the vanguard of social change and certainly of education.
That explains why I'm looking at snapshots of the early version of your site. There is a pair of glasses that's called the Huxley, another one called the Sinclair. Beckett is a third one, and it just goes on from there. That's the inspiration for the name. And also through that, you're communicating your brand's message. Am I right?
Exactly. So those early days, we literally, we didn't hire an ad agency or a branding agency, but we sort of did a lot of the exercises that these brand agencies tend to do, which is articulating what our values are, what we stand for, doing an exercise like if you were a car, what would you be? If you were a pair of jeans, you know, what would you be?
Meaning what kind of jeans, bell bottoms or skinny jeans, that kind of thing.
You could interpret it however you want. If you were a Rolling Stone, who would you be? So, you know, for our perspective, we called ourselves from a car that we would be like a Presla, which would be an in-between Prius and Tesla.
Got it.
And again, this was, you know, over 7 years ago. But the thought there is that, hey, we're environmentally aware and thoughtful. We're innovative. We're not too showy as well. So, you know, getting into those nuances make a big difference. You know, we've thought about the brand as being, somewhat collegiate. And I think that's very different than being preppy, right? And those nuances of the words and the meanings behind it and how people interpret it are what create a point of view.
I see. And the actual glasses themselves were designed by the four of you, from what I understand, based on glasses you'd admired, that you'd found over the years, based on this personality that you had. And is it true also that it was glasses that you found at your grandparents' houses?
Our first monocle. Because we had a monocle.
Yeah, the first website had a monocle on it. It was like men's – the links at the top are men, women, buy a pair, give a pair, which tells me a lot about what you stood for. That took the most prominent link at the top. Our story, which is helpful for me when I'm preparing. Monocle, and then help frequently asked question. I didn't realize you had a monocle day one. Why?
We thought it would be fun. And again, if you're building a brand centered around fun, creativity, and doing good in the world, you know, how do you bring that to life? And we were joking around one day about how come nobody wears a monocle anymore. And so we decided to sell it for the exact reason of who sells a monocle, right? So we call it the Colonel after, right, the board game Clue. And it's just, it's fun. It's certainly not a big money earner. We actually find that some chefs buy monocles because when they're in the kitchen, sometimes their glasses fog up. So it just helps to have a monocle that they throw in and out of their pocket.
Interesting. You know, you mentioned you were sitting around and you came up with this idea. You said no one wears monocles anymore. And then you came up with the need to create this as a way of expressing your brand. I asked Alexis Ohanian years ago about how he comes up with ideas when he speaks at conferences, when he's creating. And to be honest, he said, I smoke a lot of weed and talk with my friends. I imagine that's not your process. What is your process? And what was it in the early days for being this creative?
I think creativity is born out of constraints. So I think that idea of people sitting around thinking blue sky ideas and suddenly they come up with something is BS. And I think anybody that tells you that they just sit around and smoke weed, I just don't believe that. I don't see that happens. What happens is that you're faced with a problem and you start to think like, why is the world this way? Why is this particular situation exist? What would be a better way? And when people are often asking me, hey, I want to start a company, how do I do it? The answer is write down 5 frustrations every day. By the end of the week, you'll have over 30. By the end of the month, right, you'll have over 100. And then start to think about, do any of these frustrations have solutions that could be a business opportunity? And that's sort of where I see creativity and innovation comes from.
Interesting. 5 frustrations a day, not 5 ideas for a business, but 5 things that bother you or the people around you and see which ones of those could end up being businesses.
Yeah. And then we continue to do that as we grow the business. So we've now started to open up stores. We almost had 50 stores. We never envisioned opening up stores.
You know, sorry to interrupt you, but I'm glad you bring this up. I went back and listened to early interviews of yours and read early interviews of yours, and you guys seem to be combating the actual store experience. And then when you went and you created a store, I couldn't understand it. And so how did that come up what's the relationship to frustration and the stores?
So if you've ever gone and bought a pair of glasses, you likely walked into a store. The frames are in a glass display or behind the counter out of reach. You have to engage with somebody who is like passing them the glasses, telling you whether you look good or not. You don't know if you trust the person's opinion. And it's not an optimal shopping experience. When I go and you're sometimes looking at a mirror that's a vanity mirror that you can only see your face in. So there's an example of a frustration. When you walk into an optical shop, it's like, I want to touch the glasses myself. I want to throw them on. If I look silly, I'm going to laugh at myself, but I'm happy to do that. I don't necessarily want a bunch of other people seeing that and laughing at me. So when we were designing our stores, it was like, oh, let's have shelves. Let's make them eye level so they're easy to see, not, where you have to bend down to a glass display, that you can actually pick them up off the shelf, that there are full-length mirrors, right? These all seem like really basic sort of design ideas and simple functionality, but it's not being done by the industry today. And it took an outsider to look at this and to identify even a frustration to come up with a solution.
My understanding was that you guys didn't have this idea that you need to have stores. It was that people kept saying, hey, I'm in the Bay Area. You're in the Bay Area. Can I just pop into your office to try on these glasses? Am I right?
Yeah, exactly. So what happened is that when we launched in February 2010, we were featured in Vogue and GQ, and the company took off like a rocket ship. We hit our first year sales targets in 3 weeks, sold out our top 15 styles in 4 weeks. But what happened is within 48 hours, we had to temporarily suspend the home try-on program because we ran out of inventory. We had shipped out all of our frames to customers. And since we were full-time students at Wharton, people sort of called up and said, hey, we hear you're in Philadelphia. Can we come by your office to try on glasses? And we're like, oh, we're working out of our apartment. So if you want to come by, come by. And we experimented. We invited 5 people to my apartment. We put the glasses on the dining room table. We had people check out on a laptop using the website. And that was our first foray into bricks and mortar retail.
I run in the Bay Area, and every once in a while I see a yellow bus. Or I guess I used to. I don't see it anymore. A yellow bus with Warby Parker on it. I always wondered what that is. Is that like your shuttle, the equivalent of the Google shuttle, or is this something else? What is that?
What we did was our journey into retail started in my apartment. Then when we opened our first office in Manhattan, we dedicated a portion of it to be a showroom where people could come in and shop and see the people working behind the brand. And then we had this idea of almost like a cross-country tour. And what if we bought a bus or a truck, turned it into a store, and just went to different cities and told people the Warby Parker story. We bought an old yellow school bus, which are surprisingly inexpensive because actually school districts have to retire them pretty early based on state law. And we ripped out the seats. We redid the interior, put oak shelving in, and made it a beautiful mobile store. And we sold things like sweatshirts and mugs, the Warby Parker class trip. If you were one of the kids that hung out in the back of the bus, we also sold flasks. We went to over 15 cities. In each city, we would be in three locations each. And it was really a marketing activity to raise awareness. What it ended up doing was creating a roadmap of where should we open up stores, because suddenly we had data from all these different locations of where do we sell best. And on M in Wisconsin and Georgetown in D.C., we sold a lot of glasses. So now we have a store on M in Wisconsin in D.C.
I see. So it wasn't a sales. It wasn't about sales. It was about marketing, which I learned in business school are different. Sales is you actually want people to buy. Marketing is your. It's the bigger picture. I don't actually remember how they described it. Right. You just said we want the brand out there. If we get sales, it's a bonus. And through this, you got a lot of learning that allowed you to create stores. Am I right?
Yes, but we always want to have our cake and eat it too. So while it was a brand awareness activity, we wanted to sort of have it be as efficient and cost effective as possible. So we absolutely sold out of the bus, and that helped defray the cost quite a bit. But you're right, from a priority number one, it was about introducing the brand in a brand appropriate way to as many people as possible.
Paul Graham, one of the early Mixergy interviewees and a guy who's helped me a lot here at Mixergy, says that there's schlep blindness, that when there's pain, people have so become adjusted and used to it that they're blind to it. When you mentioned glasses at a store, I realized, yeah, I always hate when the person at the store watches me put on glasses, but I just never thought about it. I took it for granted that of course they're going to want to keep an eye on their glasses, and maybe I'm the fool for not being helped because I don't know how to talk to them. How did you break through that kind of blindness to pain to understand glasses shouldn't be low, let people grab them and try them on themselves? What allowed you to understand that there were these pains that you could then solve?
I think once we started zeroing in on we want to make buying glasses as fun, as easy, as convenient, and as inexpensive as possible, the world was our oyster, and we saw every single problem that was out there and the way glasses were being sold. And even to this day, we even walk into our own stores and say, hey, this is not ideal. What do we have to do to make it ideal?
I see. Is it like one of my past interviewees, Dane Maxwell? I think I'm getting this a little wrong, but I got the main gist of it right. He says, when you wear green glasses, you start to notice green everywhere. That when you start to look for problems and really are sensitized to it, you start to see problems everywhere where the rest of the world would ignore it. Am I right?
That's exactly right.
There's something that sticks with me. Again, I admire your brand so much. And maybe we can talk a little bit about how you actually, in the early days, you were so good at PR. That's how you did some fundraising, by doing PR for someone else and helping them with their brand. But you mentioned a bunch of techniques, like what car would you be? What jeans would you be? Is there a book on that or some resource that we can use as a follow-up to this conversation that I can go and look at and learn from?
I don't think that there are. I'll have to give that some thought. Okay. Not immediately come to mind. When I was working in the nonprofit sector, Skojo Foundation, we rebranded as Vision Spring. Mm-hmm. And we went through that process. That process that I literally mimicked when we were building Warby Parker.
All right. I'll talk about my second and final sponsor. It's a company called Design Crowd. Neil, as you notice, I'm so intimidated by design that, like, frankly, for me, the fact that I'm wearing these beads is like, look, I've got something that's not functional, that actually has a look to it and a feel to it. But other than that, I'm really bad at it. So for a long time, the iTunes cover art for Mixergy was just so bad. Everything was just so bad because I said, you know what? I'm going to focus on what I'm good at. I'm so curious. I could spend, Neil, hours researching you, your shirt, your history, your past interviews, and I focus on that. And the rest, I'll just ignore. And then these guys, Design Crowd, started sponsoring Mixergy, and I said, you know, I know that I can stand up and talk about them because my friends have used them and they've gotten good results. But I finally, one night when my wife was out, I said, I'm going to use Design Crowd. So I went online. I went to Design Crowd. I just filled out a simple form. I could fill out form because I'm enough of a dork that I can do that. And I said, here's what I'd like. I'd like it to feel like this. I'd like it to have this. I'd like my logo to be small because no one needs to see it. But my mission here is to tell startup stories. So feature that big. You know, I could do that kind of stuff. So I did it. And then I forgot about it, frankly. If I have a night alone, I'm going to sit and just like veg out. I think I was playing Mario Brothers or something, whatever that thing is on the iPhone, Mario Run. I had to disable it because I was playing it for too long. I had to delete it. I mean, so I forgot about it. Monday morning, I come to my office, I get my email and I think, what is this? I had like 12 different designs from 12 different designers of different cover art for my iTunes. And they were freaking great. It was so beautiful. It was like, I couldn't believe that I was worthy of this. Now, I don't have like self-image problems. Maybe I do, but I don't lack confidence. I do here felt like I'm not worthy of this design. It's so good. And I just kept going through it, giving feedback. And the next day I got more designs from more designers and giving feedback. And finally, I have like five that I'm in love with and I have to pick the right one. And that's a challenge for me. But the nice thing is I have a lot of Facebook followers. So I'm going to pull out all those designs that I like, show it to my Facebook followers, get some feedback, and then pick the one that I love. And I can't go wrong out of this five. So if you're listening to me and you're like me, you want great design for a reasonable price, I really urge you to check out this company that I've fallen in love with. It's called Design Crowd. All you have to do is go, well, actually not to designcrowd.com, but to a special URL. Again, this is created by Mixergy fan who's seen me with bad design for years, but he says, I'm going to give your audience a big discount. He's going to give us up to $100 off. You don't need to focus on iTunes cover art. Maybe you need a new logo. Maybe you need a new web design. Maybe you need a new banner for an adventure going to whatever your design needs are. Go to them. They're going to have lots of different designers pitch in and give you their ideas. You pick the one you want. You can take care of the other designers too if you love their work. Here's the URL to get that $100 discount. Go to designcrowd.com/Mixergy. designcrowd.com/Mixergy. All right. Neil, back to your story where the first funding came from you guys. You were MBAs. You had experience before. You banked some money, so you put it into the company. As I understand, it was like $120,000 total, right? Then you got a loan that was SBA-backed. Then you had this really interesting thing where you were looking for money and someone you were working with, I guess it was someone who was shipping out the glasses for you. Talk about where that extra, I think a few $100,000 came from and how it relates to PR.
Yeah, well, you know, I think people underestimate the power of PR as a tool to raise awareness, but also a tool to meet vendors and strategic partners and investors. So one of the things that happened in those early days, right, we were growing so quickly, we were having trouble getting product out to customers in a timely way. We were sending out emails, profusely apologizing. Somebody responded to the email saying, hey, it seems like you're having an issue with fulfillment. Let me see if I can help. And it turned out he was a CEO of publicly traded logistics company. We ended up moving our distribution center into one of his warehouses. Then the relationship continued to develop. He said, wow, you guys are really good at PR. You know, perhaps you could do some PR for us and give us some consulting and, you know, we'll give you sort of cash for that. And we thought, fantastic. And that helped capitalize part of the business.
How much cash did you get for that?
I need to double check, but I think it was around like $50,000 or something.
Oh, I see. Okay. I imagined it was hundreds of thousands. So it was a lot of creative fundraising. I'm wondering why you didn't go for more traditional fundraising.
In the early days, we didn't need to. With $120,000, we were able to purchase our initial inventory of frames. have those manufactured according to our design specifications, build a website, hire a PR firm. Now, again, we launched in 2010. This is all the heels of the financial crisis. So people were eager to work with us at very discounted rates. And then we launched, the business is doing great. Sales are coming in like crazy. It was 15 months before we did our first round. And that also enabled us to raise money on our own terms to ensure that we as founders were protected and had control of the company so we could see our vision through. And even to this day, our board of directors is the four of us founders, plus two investors, plus Mickey Drexler, the chairman and CEO of J. Crew.
Yeah, I saw that. Is it true that Jeff Fleur, the founder of StubHub, was one of your early seed investors?
He was.
What was your connection to him?
A Wharton grad. We met him through sort of the alumni network.
Really? So you just said he's a grad, he's founded StubHub, let's reach out and tell him what we're doing and see if he's interested in investing.
Yeah, well, we started to talk to the entrepreneurial community at Wharton and at Penn. His name would start to pop up. We started to try and get advice from local investors in Philly, like Josh Koppelman of First Round Capital. Mm-hmm. And Mentor Tech, which is also sort of right on Penn's campus.
David Smith, who I don't know well, was also a Wharton graduate, I think, right?
Exactly. Davis right now runs Code Epoxy. Pooltables.com had started baby.co.br in Brazil. So we really leveraged our classmates, our professors, alumni.
Is Crunchbase right? $215 million raised in five rounds from a lot of great investors?
Yeah, our last round, we raised over $100 million. That was led by T. Rowe Price. We've had Tiger Global lead two of our rounds, General Catalyst, led one of our rounds. And then our first round was co-led by SV Angel, First Round Capital, and Lear Hippo Ventures. Okay. One of the things that we believed is trying to get as many advocates onto our cap table as possible. So as we think about fundraising, we wanted geographic coverage, and that generally meant New York, Bay Area, and LA. We wanted industry coverage, so tech investors, people that understood retail and fashion, people that understood entertainment, including film and music. So even somebody like Jimmy Buffett is an investor in Warby Parker, as is Ashton Kutcher, as is Troy Carter, who used to be Lady Gaga's manager. Right. We've got some interesting people on board.
I remember hearing from angel investors that some of their investments are really good at communicating and asking for things, and others just go MIA completely because it turns out they just feel insecure about asking or they're not sure what to ask. I'm wondering, with all these great investors and such a strategic approach to finding the right investors, what's your process for taking advantage of those relationships properly so that they can help you grow?
We're probably in that latter category where we don't reach out nearly as much as we could, but often for a different reason, often because we're super busy. Some of the asks aren't as obvious, but when they come to us, we absolutely do. So an example is Forerunner Ventures is one of our investors. In early days, we reached out to Kirsten Green. Before starting her own venture fund, she had been a retail analyst. So when we were thinking about going into bricks and mortar, we asked her, hey, who was behind Apple's real estate strategy? And she was like, I know exactly who that is. It's a guy named Mark Masinter, who's based in Dallas. Give me 2 seconds. She gave him a call. It turned out he was in New York. Later that day, he was in our office giving us our advice. We've been working with him now for several years.
I see.
And has helped us roll out, 50 stores. So that's an example. I find that if you want to take advantage of investors, asking specific questions having specific asks tends to have the best outcome. General broad-reaching things, You know, just like you want to set SMART goals with your team, mm-hmm. you want to ask your investors SMART questions.
I mentioned earlier that CenterLink on warbyparker.com back in 2011 was buy a pair, comma, give a pair, a link to your do-gooder project. I'm wondering why, when you guys barely had any money, why, when you were trying to establish yourselves as a design company that also was inexpensive, why bother with that? What was your vision for that? What was your goal there?
The goal was the same goal of starting the company. We wanted to create an organization that we were excited to come to work every day, where we weren't going to roll over and hit the snooze button. And that came down.
Is money enough? Like, I'm making more money. I'm helping people wear glasses that they love. Isn't that enough to wake up at and get out of bed? I'm giving people jobs.
Not for the four of us. And I find most of the entrepreneurs that I know, while they certainly love a good financial outcome, they didn't necessarily start the company with the explicit goal of getting rich, right? They started the company to build a company to solve a problem. Building a successful company, that's an awesome outcome, right? If you're able to provide for your family. Here, we believe that we were bringing down the price of glasses from $500 to $95, and that was going to help hundreds of millions of people, primarily in North America and eventually Europe and maybe parts of Asia, but there were still hundreds of millions of people that didn't have access to glasses, the people that couldn't afford $95. So from day one, we wanted to serve them. And we thought, okay, well, we can donate maybe a percentage of revenue or a certain dollar amount. But at the end of the day, you know, those amounts can be manipulated, especially if we weren't in control of the company anymore. And at the end of the day, that doesn't equal impact. Dollars and cents, big or small, doesn't equal impact. What equals impact is a human being with a pair of glasses that can see the blackboard and learn and excel in school, that can use their glasses to continue their work and earn a living. So we committed to distribute a pair of glasses for every pair that we sell, and we've now distributed several million.
Distributed to me means giving out. But before we talked, I called my wife, who's in the do-gooder space and has been for a long time. The merging of doing good works and building a good company. She's been in this for a while. And I said, what do you think of this buy one, give one? She said, oftentimes when companies do it, what happens is they come into a needy place and they give a bunch of stuff, like maybe they would give a bunch of glasses, and then they put all the people out of business who would otherwise be selling glasses, and they turn people off that way. I said, so what do you think of Warby Parker's process? She says, they have something that's innovative. They partner up with the nonprofit, and then they locally partner up properly. And then they do something that I read about on your site, which is sell to the end user, it turns out. Talk about that. Why do you have it structured that way? Why aren't you just giving out one pair of glasses? There's a reason for it.
Well, the reason is that good intentions can sometimes have unintended results. And me, having worked in international development, saw that all the time, where there was a lot of good intentioned people that donate money or engage in work to help people less fortunate, but sometimes have bad outcomes. For example, right, sometimes giving away clothes for free could, in an environment that's not, you know, an acute crisis like a refugee scenario, if it's an economic development scenario where there is an economy functioning, but it's just not as robust as you would like, right? Giving away a bunch of stuff for free can sometimes, you know, hurt that growing economy, as opposed to giving people skill sets and helping them grow existing businesses and jobs there. So when we looked at people that need glasses, the people that are most impacted are students or people that are actively working, and the glasses help them see. So we thought, when I was working at Vision Spring, what if we trained low-income women to start their own businesses, giving eye exams and selling glasses? And you sell the glasses so that way people value them and they'll use them. And it's a forcing function to make sure that you're selling product that people want to use. Mm-hmm. So it's the ultimate feedback loop. The second thing is that it creates jobs. In this case, it creates jobs for women, which has a great multiplier effect because every study shows that when women have access to capital, they tend to use it on the education and healthcare of their children far more than men. And in a lot of these communities, women are underemployed. So this seemed to be a win-win. So when, as Warby Parker, we were deciding how do we distribute our glasses, we said, oh, we know Vision Spring. Neil used to work there. Let's work with them. Let's make contributions that enable Vision Spring to procure glasses. And then they in turn sell it to the entrepreneur who in turn sells it in their community, obviously at a price that's affordable. So in Bangladesh, that might be a couple dollars. You know, in El Salvador or Guatemala, that might be, you know, closer to $6, $7, $8, $9, $10.
I see. You mentioned the name Warby Parker. I didn't bring it up, but I think it's fairly well known at this point that it came from Jack Kerouac's journal. There were two characters in there, Zag Parker and Warby Pepper. You connected the last name of one with the first name of the other. You came up with Parker, with Warby Parker. I'm wondering, like, you did that with, did you intend that some people would think of it as like two founders who started the company, like Barnes & Noble? Or was there this sense that you just wanted a feel that came from those two names?
Yeah, we definitely didn't want to confuse people and make them think that there was this human being, Warby Parker, or that there were founders named it. We just thought that this best exemplified the concept and the brand that we were building. And the name itself, right, sounds kind of quirky, Warby. The Parker sort of grounds it, yeah. Right? It sounds like something that you're familiar with. So hopefully we have instant credibility. And you need credibility when you're selling, even though glasses are a fashion accessory, they're also a health product. And it's got that tie to Kerouac, right? Who's a great American writer who had a big impact and certainly is somebody when you think about taking their own path as somebody who does that. And as a company, we're trying to do that.
And the actual company name is Jand Inc. Jand, I'm assuming, is the four initials of the four co-founders, right?
Yep. Jeff, Andy, Neil, Dave. And of course, that's because we incorporated before we came up with the name Warby Parker.
No, so the one bit of negative stuff that I found online was I went to Glassdoor and several people had said that they weren't getting paid much for working at Warby Parker. You've seen this. What do you say about that? What do you say to someone who says, 2 years ago, Warby Parker was a competitive paying job. It is break even with Walmart at this point. It doesn't say competitive pay to most people.
It's pretty much untrue. You know, I speak with a lot of CEOs. I've never seen or spoken to somebody who is happy at their job and takes the time to write something on Glassdoor. But I do know people that are upset and that have been fired, that write negative reviews. I know competitors that write negative reviews on other folks. But you know, our compensation structure is something that we think very seriously about. And we also communicate it very clearly to folks when they join. Our benefits program is best in class. It's part of our core ethos of being a B Corporation and thinking about each stakeholder, right? Our not just our shareholders, but our customers, our employees, the environment and the community at large.
The other thing I saw actually was on Pando. Pando said that your one big challenge is that you've got 2 minutes.
Yeah, because I'm running to actually meet.
I'll just finish off with this. That they said that there were other people who could come in cheaper than you because they had their own factories. You guys were using other factories in China. It seems like based on the intro that the line that you gave me to describe Warby Parker, you guys now own your own factories. You said vertically integrated lifestyle brand. Is that true?
So we design all of our own frames. We work with third-party manufacturers to create our frames. Those are manufactured predominantly in Asia and in Italy and soon Japan. And then we cut-and-edge the lenses predominantly in the U.S. in five different locations. We've just opened up our own optical lab We'll be hiring 130 people. That's in Sloatsburg, New York, a little over an hour outside the city, where we cut the lenses, insert them into the frames, and ship them to customers.
Okay. All right. Finally, what's the best part of having built this business? You've worked at it for years. You've worked on it every day. What's the best part of having done all this work?
The best part is coming to work every day and being able to work with really smart, really friendly and nice people. And I think one of the things that I take a lot of pride in is that we just hired our 1,000th employee. Wow. And we had a big celebration. We created this big wall where we wrote everybody's name and people could go on and sign the name. And lo and behold, there were two names right next to each other. And it was two people that met Warby Parker and gotten married.
Wow.
Like, that's just the most awesome thing in the world. And it was just funny that they also happened to be, I think it was like the 21st person at the on the team and the 22nd person.
Oh, wow. Well, I just love your brand. I've said this several times before. Everything that you guys do, including the way that you bring your brand to the to local cities with that bus, is just so clever, but doesn't feel overly worked on. It's just subtle beauty, and I love watching it. The website, of course, for actually everyone knows it. It's Warby Parker and the two sponsors that I mentioned in this interview. The first is a company that will help you hire your next great developer, toptal.com/Mixergy. And the next is a company that I use to get a great design. It's called Design Crowd. Check them out at designcrowd.com/Mixergy. Neil, thanks so much for doing this. I know you got a busy schedule, and I really appreciate you squeezing me in because, as I've said, I've wanted to get you on for months because I'm such an admirer of your company. Thank you.
Thanks so much. It's awesome to be on.
Same here. Bye, everyone. Thank you.